Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books and Literary Studies. I am John Yargo, your host. Today's guest is Masjid Mayar, an assistant professor of American Studies at Bielefeld University and the incoming professor of American Studies at University of Cologne. Masjid has just published Citizens and Rulers of the World, The American Child, and the Cartographic Pedagogies of Empire with the University of North Carolina Press. Citizens and Rulers of the World recovers how American children at the turn of the 20th century, navigated knowledge about world geography in the shadow of the rapidly expanding American empire. Welcome to the show, Masjid.
Thank you, John. Thanks for having me.
To begin with, this book triangulates a relationship between the contested formations of empire, childhood, and cartography. Did you always know this would be the structure of your work? And can you discuss the evolution of this project?
Yeah, thank you for this question. I guess that actually takes me back over 10 years to the time when I was an MA student, and I worked on a project for my MA thesis, which looked into the question of globalization through U.S. history. And in that project, I was zooming in at the end of the 19th century, so roughly the same time period that I am looking at in my book. And what I did was I looked at the question of Americans imagining the world as becoming smaller and smaller because the scope of and the range of the influence, the territorial expanse of U.S. empire was expanding at the same time. So I was looking at these two forces, bringing the United States closer and closer to the world at a moment that the United States was expanding overseas. In order to explore these ideas, I was looking at a lot of magazines and different types of written media at this time period. But then when I moved on to the PhD program at the history department, so moving away from American studies, landing in history, what I did was I actually focused a lot on a specific age group, which is children. And I also sharpened this idea of cartography out of the spatialized understanding that I was trying to get at in my MA thesis project, which was looking at a smaller world and expanding U.S. empire at the same time. And so then cartography actually moved gradually to the center of my thinking about U.S. empire at the turn of the 20th century. And what was added to it through the figure of the child was starting to think about the question of education. I had a wonderful conversation with the late Amy Kaplan, and she actually brought to my attention the work of Professor Patricia Crane. And what happened was that I actually began to look more and more into the question of childhood and the fraught relationship between children and empire, and also between childhood as a concept and empire as a power constellation that was being contested at this time. So a lot of different forces came together, basically, and different conversations that I had, so that I moved from a general skeleton, really, to a more complicated anatomy of the question of empire at this point.
Can you sketch out the scholarship that you're engaging with? What's the state of the field, and how do citizens and rulers of the world fit in?
Yeah, so there's actually a lot of scholarship on historical childhood, particularly in relation to the United States, what it meant for children to learn what it means to be an American, being pre-political members of a state that identified often as a young nation and later on as a young empire. So the idea of youth is, of course, there when you think about the U.S. empire, but also United States as a nation in the 19th century. And that, of course, necessarily means that children are a presence, even if not centrally in a lot of these conversations. And a lot of American historians and American studies colleagues have written about childhood in relationship to empire, childhood and projects of education and pedagogy in general. For example, Karen Sanchez-Epler, with whom I had the pleasure of working, who's at Amherst College, and her wonderful book, which is the very first book that I bought actually as a graduate student when I started my PhD. The book is called Dependent States. And there she has this brilliant chapter, which is called Raising Empires Like Children. And even the title of that chapter is actually very thought-provoking, because it is not about what role and place childhood has in empire, but actually what empire and studies related to the question of empire actually owe to childhood studies and to the figure of the child. Michelle Honeck has a book that came out in 2018. It's called Our Frontier is the World. And there he looks at Boy Scouts movement and how the Boy Scouts and also the Girl Scouts movement was actually an imperial project, which was writing fun and playfulness and patriotism into childhood as a project that was very much at the center of the imperial projects at the end of the 19th century. Jeff Barisox, who has written a book in 2013, focuses in his book Raising Germans in the Age of Empire about childhood in Germany, actually, and looking at childhood in the classroom, outside the classroom, around the campfire, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, there are all these geographical and spatialized conversations about the question of childhood in 19th century, early 20th century United States, work by Martha Buchner and Susan Schulton, who talk about cartography in relationship to politics. And then both of them have chapters in which they extensively discuss the idea of childhood, and particularly pedagogy and cartographies of childhood in conversation with politics. So there's a lot out there, actually, and I have learned so much from them, and it has been an exciting imaginary conversation, sometimes also real conversations with Michelle Honeck, with Karen Sanchez-Epler, and Martin Berkner, but a lot of them actually through books, and I thank books in the acknowledgement section of my book, because I learned so much from these people without them knowing me.
Thank you for that, yeah. Citizens and Rulers of the World uses a broad range of primary sources, from Nathaniel Dwight's 1795 geography primer for children to magazines marketed to children, such as St. Nicholas and Harper's Young People. How did you select your archive? How did you go about putting together the sources you would examine?
Well, that is a question about how itinerant academics are, basically, especially historians, because before doing this project, I had always heavily relied on published works, and I was doing American studies, which is kind of a different field, really. But once I started to look at myself as a historian, and over the years, what happened was that I really learned that spending time in the archives means being always ready to have your intentions modified by accidents. So there are a lot of verbs that come to my mind when I think about how I actually selected or put together this archive. And that is, I was roaming about, having conversation with people, standing in line at the Library of Congress to grab coffee and striking a conversation with a total stranger. Talking to professors at different universities, reading books, and beginning to ask whether this is a direction to explore. Would I find something at that collection? And it really was this journey that was both digital and online, because I didn't have access to so many resources and I couldn't travel frequently to the US, but also a lot of material that I had to digitize myself, because back in time, at least in 2010, when I started this project, a lot of sources that were specifically directed toward children were not digitized. So I spent 3 months at the Library of Congress in one go, and I digitized tens of thousands of pages of children's magazines, and same at Princeton University at the Kotzen Children's Library, again a few years later at the International Youth Library in Munich. Ordering books, asking for catalogs in the hope that I will actually find out more, trying to actually sit with the gaps in my understanding of an image which was very broad. And it necessarily meant that there were so many spots on it that I was not sure about. Not many people have really explored that archive, looking at children's own writing, children's own geographical puzzle production practices. So that meant a lot of uncertainty that I had to take stock of.
You make the case that knowledge about world geography in the 1890s and the first decade of the 1900s was tied in with the project of securing the future of an American empire. At the same time, these maps invited a degree of personalized intimacy and allowed for users to contend with officially endorsed geography. Can you talk with us about how knowledge about the world was made and the purposes to which geographically scripted material were put?
Thank you. Yeah. In general, of course, thinking about geographically scripted material, we automatically think about maps, official maps that were produced in the cartography workshops of the state. And they were produced in order to give people an idea of what it means to occupy a space among so many other nations around the world, especially at the time when Americans were actively considering what it meant for them to be in and of the world. So this is a moment of searching for the place that the United States has on world maps. And as I explore in the beginning chapter of my book, it's a really interesting trajectory that American so U.S.-produced maps are actually following at this point in time, trying to gradually move the world maps that are printed, included in school books, for example, so that the world map centers on the Americas. Because over the course of the 19th century, this is not the case. And more often, this happens at the end of the century, that maps are printed in which the United States is basically at the center of the Mercator projection. And again, this happens a lot in American school books of the time. And I was looking at this, asking myself what this centering of the world on the United States actually means for Americans' sense of national identity, of belonging to the world, but also being an empire that is shifting its scope of influence across the globe. So this is the official part. This is the beginning point, actually, of what it means to engage with, but also produce geographically scripted material. But then there are so many other instances of such material, and that includes memoirs and letter writing, so epistolary relationships. That also involves board games, dissected maps that children could play with, including also playing with their parents or older siblings. So there's a whole lot of unofficial but commercialized geographically scripted material that children specifically had access to. And they could learn about who they are as future citizens of an empire that was expanding its imperial ambitions, but also in response to which children themselves could actually sit and imagine who they are, where they are on the map of the world. So as I explore in the second part of the book, I looked at examples of how children playfully, but very earnestly at times, wrote about their journeys to different parts of the world, gave accounts of encountering non-Americans, non-whites in quarantine stations, or if they learned about them in school, how they developed a language which was very spatial, very much about geography, about the boundaries of the nation, about the idea of home, and then who belonged to it and who was excluded from it. Also, children designed and had geographical puzzles printed in juvenile periodicals of the time, and the two that I look at is specifically St. Nicholas and Harper's Young People. And they would print child-manufactured puzzles that are all focused on geography. And they are fascinating geographically scripted material in which what you encounter is a lot of hesitation and fascination with the idea of the world at the same time. And you can look at patterns that these children's understanding of world geography followed, and how they consumed this very prominent pedagogical method of home geography, which meant that looking at world geography consists of an endless number of home or local geographies. And it was this comparative method of making geography fun, but also understandable and tangible for children. So children engaged with the idea of home through their letters and geographical puzzles. And that's a whole category of super interesting, very generative, but also really short and heavily edited texts that children themselves produced.
That is really fascinating. And I'd like to explore that a little bit further. One of the chapters focuses on geographic puzzles during a period of the 20th century, which you identify as the puzzle and game hysteria moment. Can you tell us how the labor that children put into puzzling out geographic maps interacted with the kinds of child play generated through these puzzles?
Yeah, gladly. That was one of the most fun sections of the book to write, actually, because I was thinking a lot about the imaginaries at work, also for me as a historian of the US, trying to get close to the figure of the child, excited, breathless, bored, amazed, trying to put whatever they had learned at school into use when they were playing with dissected maps, and also theorizing my understanding of what was going on. So there's a lot of speculation that I have tried to actually make sense of through engaging with the figure of the child as a reinscriptive cartographer, meaning that children played with dissected maps, which consisted of 50, 100, sometimes many more pieces of a geographical whole, a map that manufacturers such as McLachlan Brothers would just chop into pieces, mount on cardboard, and sell in nicely decorated boxes to parents who would then gift it to their children. And so children would encounter the map of the world or map of the United States or map of the Philippines after the Philippines actually became under U.S. imperial influence in 1898. And what they encountered was not one map, but many maps. They were really, really small, and their edges would fit into one another. But at the same time, they would worry so much about how they would come together. So for children, these small maps mattered as much as the whole, sometimes even more, because they had to complete the puzzle by making sure that the edges actually fit one another. It was not that much about the entire map that they were trying to put together, but the pieces that mattered in production of that whole, actually. And that is a whole fascinating level of engaging with geography, which is tactile, visual, and also playful. And these dissected maps were meant to keep children silent, as the brochure enclosed in one of the boxes of a dissected map explicitly mentioned as a bonus to having children play with these games, that they would be kept as silent as mice, because the idea was that children have so many hours after school. What do? They go outside and play, or if you want to keep them in the safety of home, then they can play board games or with dissected maps, and they can in the silence of their play also relearn about American geography, about world geography, and then imagine where they are on the map of the world. But then, of course, there are all these challenges to the idea of a dissected map at the same time, because a lot of these dissected maps were one-sided, and so children could draw something on the other side, which was blank, and then play with that image of, I don't know, their family, or another image that they could stick to it with glue, instead of engaging with the map of the world. But at the same time, still the map side was there. It was present, and it was meant to actually help them rehearse what they learned at the classroom within the perimeters of home.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I like to talk about the writing process for academics. I, for one, emulate the academic writers that I admire. I keep a running list of sentences from monographs that I admire or articles that I enjoy reading. For you, how do research projects come together? What are your ultimate goals as a stylist? What are your tactics as a writer, as a reviser? Are you a part of a writing group or a workshop?
Thank you for this question. Well, I definitely agree with the example that you just mentioned. I also do that. I have a notebook and I keep a list, an expanding list of sentences, even academic verbs that I think like I am not using often enough in my own writing. And I also always suggest it to my students, especially because I teach and work in Germany. I constantly remind my students that it is okay to actually do that as non-native speakers of English. So I'm happy to hear that you do the same thing. I am always very much focused on the question of elegance when I write. Because in another life, I'm a poet, and that means that I smuggle ideas and sensations, ways of using language, thinking about different arguments, which are very much literary. And of course, over the years, I had to encounter this as not necessarily always a positive thing that I do, because I was joining a camp of scholars, namely historians, who had a different understanding of how arguments should be built, how evidence should be brought in, et cetera, et cetera. So for me, of this past decade has been a journey in coming to terms with the two faces that I have, one being someone who is fascinated by creative writing and does that a lot for herself, also recently publishing a bit of that poetry. And the other side, someone who, as an Americanist, has a book out, which is a cultural history of the United States. And finding the balance between these two has never been easy, but really interesting to explore. So I don't write the way I wrote 10 years ago when I finished my MA thesis, for example. That is a more pleasurable read, I would say, than what I produced later on in different chapters of my book, scholarly articles that I have published and so on, because I tried to be more and more and more precise and use less flourish in my writing style. Ultimately, of course, I am one of those writers who keeps revising endlessly, basically. And I have smuggled back in some of my favorite ways of writing, particularly the acknowledgements to my book, I think is a pleasurable piece that I have written, where I am the closest to my usual writing style. But going back to academic writing, again, how the different chapters actually came together. I always gave myself deadlines, which were very real and coming from outside, not from my committee, but from different conferences and workshops and summer schools that I attended. So I would intentionally choose different events that were important to my work, to the general field in which I was thinking about the United States, but also at intervals. So I always had deadlines for myself to push me to produce more text, and also to engage with different groups of people who were thinking about similar or dissimilar projects, questions, time periods, and trying to connect my line of thinking, my arguments, whatever I was writing, to that group of people, trying to help them understand what I was working on. And that meant having a million different summaries for my project that I thought would actually make sense in that summer school or at that annual convention. And that also meant producing constantly. So I wrote not in one go. I didn't block a year and a half for writing at the end of my time as a doctoral researcher. But basically throughout time, I would just write drafts and then go back to them after a couple of semesters of going yet again to another conference and trying to mature that text by revising it. So I am a master reviser, I would say.
Well, let me say, you know, the poetic sensibility and the emphasis on elegance that you talk about comes through in the book. It is a pleasure to read, for sure. One of the things I was struck by in doing some of my research is the titles of your courses, which are very compelling. You have offered courses titled "The Verbs of Empire" and another course, Silence in U.S. History and Culture. This book, The Citizens and Rulers of the World, is invested in the ethics of education and pedagogy. How did your own teaching inform this research project, and how did working on this project affect your approach to teaching?
That's a brilliant question. My answer to which is, I am a completely different teacher now than I was when I started this project, because through looking at childhood, not in terms of age, but in terms of access to power and access to political power also, I began to reflect a lot about what it means to be a student. So one of the many phases of childhood that I explicitly explore in my book is children as students. And by getting close to that figure, which is really elusive, has not been reconstructed that often in historical work so far, because either the focus has been on school books or on test results or records that schools kept rather than what children themselves actually produced. Not much has been said about the American child, the student, and in general, the child as a student, at least in the work that I have explored. And that means that going through the material that I was working with for writing my book, I began to develop a very different relationship to the idea of childhood. And at some point, I even wrote a letter to the editor of St. Nicholas, in the very way that children in the 1890s, well, over the course of the final quarter of the 19th century, wrote to St. Nicholas. So I wrote a letter addressed to dear St. Nicholas, and I wrote about how I always wanted to go to the kindergarten, but for a variety of reasons, it wasn't possible, and how heartbroken I was as a child. And then on the other side of the same page, I wrote a letter to dear St. Nicholas as an Americanist, an adult, saying that this is the year 2012 or 13, I believe it was. And I am researching you. And this is my position. This is my relationship to childhood, actually. So coming back to the question of teaching, I think occupying these different positions and getting close to the image of the child as a quote-unquote minor member of society in general also made me more and more conscious about what it means to occupy a position of power, no matter how much you try to break it down, to go away from it as an instructor. And then being on the other side of the desk, so to say, being a student and struggling with that imaginary hierarchy that exists, with that very real hierarchy that exists, that spatial regimentation of the classroom into a place which is near the board, which means that you have access to writing material. Your ideas go to the blackboard. People who are younger than you, oftentimes, but not necessarily students in the class, are going to take notes of, or are supposed to take notes on, whatever you put on the board or on the PowerPoint slide, etc., etc. So there's this relationship that is you produce and the student consumes. And this was very much not the reality of what children did in my project. And over the years, I tried to actually remind myself that this is exactly what is happening in the classroom, that not everything that I produce is consumed by my students, not in the ways that I expect them to. And also, a lot of times they bring in conversations, topics, ideas that I don't even know about. And I always tell them, own your ideas, because you have done research on this topic in ways that I may never have. You may have thought about this text in ways that I may never have. So in my silence and silencing seminar, for example, we have a lot of conversations about texts, artwork, time periods in US history that I have never really worked on specifically myself. And my students help me learn, help me develop as a listener, basically. So I really like the idea of, you know, the title of my silence seminar, which is because it also tells me as an instructor that sometimes I really have to shut up and listen. And I think that's a gift that these children basically over a course of a century brought into my life as an academic.
Yeah, I agree with that. We could all do better sometimes to listen to our students or learn from them. I know this book has only recently been published, but have you given thought to what your next project might be?
Well, there are two ways of answering this question. One is short. Definitely, I am working on two projects. The longer answer is I finished my dissertation in 2016, and I believe that I have my book contract in 2019. So everything was slowed down due to the pandemic, of course. And the book came out in 2022. But since 2016, I have been working on a number of projects. One is looking at US empire through the lens of digital games. And I am currently working on the manuscripts of a book that I wish to soon send out for reviews. And it is about a concept in game studies, which is, in my understanding, my wording, unplayability, and I have been working on that concept for a while now, again, slowed down by the pandemic. But in Germany, and I don't know if you're aware of it, you publish your first book, which is based on your dissertation, and then you need to have a second book also written and published within a number of years after your PhD, and only after you have defended that project and have that book published, you can actually start applying for professorships to become a full professor and get a permanent position. So I am actually in the middle of that process of working on my second book, the so-called Habilitation in German academia. And there I am looking at poetry of erasure, which is a subcategory of documental poetry. And again, I connect that very much to my life as a historian of the US, looking at poetry of erasure, particularly instances of it published since 2001, as scripts of empire, as texts, documents / poems that engage with the idea of empire, trying to get back at the archives of empire.
We will keep our eyes out for those projects. Thank you for coming on the show, Masha.
Thank you for having me. That was wonderful.